on our calendar for oral argument is Gary Froderman versus Chandler Feed Company et al. Counsel, we're proceeding by Zoom, as you know, thanks to the technical issue, but the same rules will apply as do in any other oral argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes, followed by 15 minutes for respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you both state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your oral argument. We are making an audio recording, and that is the only recording that may be made of this proceeding today. So, with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Daniel Wettering. I am the attorney for the appellant, Gary Froderman. To start this case, the Minnesota Supreme Court set forth the focus of res judicata in Hochschild, that whether the application of res judicata would work an injustice on the party against whom the doctrine is urged, and that it should only be invoked only after careful inquiry, because it may govern grounds and defenses not previously litigated, and therefore blockades unexplored paths that may lead to the truth. And that cited the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Brown v. Felsen as well.
Mr. Wettering, before you get too far into the merits, I wanted to clarify something for purposes of our review or get your thought on it. The judge did not use the words Rule 12, and I didn't see it in any motion papers, and also did not use the word summary judgment or make re I didn't see any reference to that in the papers, but it does appear that the parties submitted affidavits and mostly related to prior litigation on the collection matter, but also the judge made reference in the order to comments made during conciliation court and other references. And I know that's a separate issue argument you make. My main point is, does it seem based on all of that that we're reviewing it as a summary judgment dismissal based on res judicata?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
All right, and proceeding here. So to bar a plaintiff's claims under res judicata, four elements must be present under the Hochschild test, and respondent concedes as much. Element number one, the earlier claim involved the same set of factual circumstances. Element two, the earlier claim involved the same parties or their privies. Earlier three, or element three, there was a final judgment on the merits. And element four, the party had a full and fair opportunity to litigate the matter. All four are required to bar appellant's claim. If one is not present, this court must reject the doctrine of res judicata. And to start, the court and Chandler in their brief cite Hochschild, Rucker, and Brown v. Wilbur. In each case, the trial court dismissed the claims under the doctrine of res judicata. And in each case, the appeals court reversed the lower court's decision and held that res judicata did not apply. So starting with element number one, plaintiff's negligence action asserts that on June 23rd, 2021, a specific delivery of defective feed by Chandler, manufactured by Hubbard, killed Mr. Froderman's calves.
And what record evidence supports your assertion that the allegedly defective feed delivered on that day was not part of the underlying collection action?
It's a good question, Your Honor. I was going to get to that, but I'll address it right away. So once the collection started in conciliation court, it was removed to the district court. And when it was removed, it's de novo. And when it was removed, Chandler then amended their complaint, taking out the invoice for the June 23rd delivery that's at issue here today. So it wasn't part of the district court record. It had nothing to do with, and referring to the court to addendum page four, Chandler's agent said as much in her affidavit.
Is that affidavit, was that affidavit part of the record presented to the district court on your motion or on the
Yes.
motion for summary judgment?
Yes. All right, let me read it. You believe so. And that was, I'll get the quote here. The balance owed on the statements attached as Exhibit A have nothing to do with the feed Mr. Froderman claimed he had issues with, or the feed that was returned by Mr. Froderman, as the $9,215.09 is for separate feed sold to Mr. Froderman and not paid for by Mr. Froderman. So, that the prior action was a collection, and this is separate because in the first case, the appellant, Mr. Froderman, was the defendant in the case, not the plaintiff. And Hubbard was not a party to the case because they have nothing to do with collecting unpaid statements by Chandler's customers. So
Counsel, just
once
to
they admit, oh.
may I ask just to make sure that I understand your arguments, and it may be clear from your brief, and I apologize if I don't, but is your argument that res judicata does not apply even if the June 23rd purchase is part of the collection action, but your secondary argument is it was not part of it, and so it does not apply? I just want to understand if you have both arguments. Does it matter whether June 23rd, for your purposes, that the June, could you succeed? In other words, does res judicata not apply even if June 23rd purchase is included? Or do you concede that res judicata would apply then?
Well, I would concede that the argument is much more difficult because the complaint specifically alleges that, and then the record that's shared with the court was that that invoice was removed and that they were credited. And then along with the affidavit of Chandler's agent, they all but admit the feed that Mr. Froderman had issue with was not part of the collection.
I guess
I
even
hope
if
that
it were
answers your
part of
question.
it, well, I just wanted to know whether you would argue, but you still should succeed even if it was part
So,
of the collection. That's my
yes,
question.
because only one element has to fail. So Hubbard was, it's not the same parties or privies as the earlier claim. Hubbard had nothing to do with Chandler. And so once they weren't part of the suit. Now, if Chandler had manufactured the feed and distributed it, that's one thing. But they had another manufacturer, another party that was that's a necessary party in this claim. And that this is a tort claim on negligence. That was a collection action. They're completely separate in our view of the case.
Mr. Wettering,
And yep.
I'm kind of on that same line of questions, separate from whether the CFO's affidavit is part of the record, and it looks to me like it's undisputed by the parties that your client was not billed for the feed that he now alleges killed the calves. And I say that because it looks like both in the arguments, district court, not so much to our court, respondent, conceded that, but disagreed with your legal conclusion of that in relation to whether it's the same set of circumstances. And I noticed also in the district court that, as part of an affidavit that respondents submitted in the collection or from the collection case to our district court here below, was the same statements you're referring to that your client, I think you submitted in your client's complaint, in fact, that show that there was credit given for all of that feed. So would I be safe to say that it's undisputed that your client was not, in the end, billed for that, or at least it came off the billing, so was not sued for that in the collection action?
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's why the Mr. Froderman allowed that to go to judgment and paid said judgment because he didn't dispute the rest of the invoices. So, Then I'll go on to just one moment, Your Honor. They make the argument that the omissions in the previous thing, because Froderman didn't respond or answer to it, they were deemed admitted. We concede that, but those were for the unpaid invoices. This invoice was separate from that by their own addendum, by their own admission. So the court referring to that in the respondent's brief citing that is kind of irrelevant. And in going on with that,
Mr. Wedding, are you
those
referring there
admissions
to
don't.
the request for admission was whether there was any set offs to the amount being sought in the collection action, correct?
Yes, correct. Correct.
And your point being is that once the credit was given for the bad feed bill, there would be no set offs.
Correct.
Thank you.
Yep. And then I'll kind of make like a small analogy of if you're a car dealership and you order, a Chevy Suburban, a Blazer, and a Malibu, and you only have the issue with the Suburban, and you pay the other two, those are entirely separate transactions. Each transaction that Mr. Froderman had with Chandler is a separate transaction, because maybe he's ordering a different quantity, maybe he's ordering feed that's manufactured by another company. So let's say that I'm saying that, I'll digress. I'll go to the next argument. So on to element two, that the earlier claim involved the same parties or their privies. Chandler argues that the earlier action involved the same parties and that allowing plaintiff's claim could end run a prior adjudication by including a new defendant. This is false. Hubbard was a necessary party. They manufactured the feed that's at issue. We didn't just add them to run and run around. They'd have an argument if Chandler had manufactured the feed, but that's n not a dispute. We added them for that, and it has no relation to the collection of the unpaid invoices.
Would you agree, counsel, that application of res judicata wouldn't work any sort of injustice as to Hubbard?
Right.
Right. I mean,
Correct.
isn't that the point of res judicata?
Yes. Yes. And then citing, going back to the court's decision, their legal analysis, they say that plaintiff and Chandler were both parties collection to the conciliation action in district court appeal. Although the defendant Hubbard has been added, including a new party, does not overcome the second prong. If it did, aggrieved parties could simply add a new party and get around the second prong of this for endless in litigation. Now, I take issue with that because the Hubbard was a necessary party. We're not just doing that, adding a party to subvert the earlier decision. The Chandler and Hubbard's feed are what we're claiming was defective. And so they were a necessary party. They weren't just added to disregard the previous ruling. He paid said judgment. He's done with that. This is a separate matter. And I'll go on to talk about a few of the cases that are cited by the court and by Chandler. I'll start with Hochschild, and they brought an action for a breach of duty, negligence, and gross negligence, failing to protect the best interests of the plaintiffs. And the parties had prior litigation over similar issues and predicated on similar facts. The same judge in that prior action was assigned to Hochschild's action, second action, and held the claims were collaterally stopped because they were previously litigated. And we had the same issue because the judge on this matter was the same judge in the conciliation court matter, and he referred to it in throughout his order in legal analysis. And then the Court of Appeals, the Minnesota Court of Appeals, reversed the holding that res judicata applied because the parties were not the same in privity with one another, and the issues were they were predicated on similar facts but not identical. Same here. There's some similar facts of deliveries, but they're not identical. This defective feed delivery we're alleging was not at issue in the district court.
Mr. Wettering, your time has expired, but you will be able to pick up on this argument on rebuttal. Thank you.
Thanks, Your
Honor. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Chris Wills. I represent the respondent, Chandler Feed, in this matter. Chandler Feed respectfully requests that the court affirm the district court's order granting its motion for summary judgment and dismissing Mr. Froderman's claims. Two things that I want to talk about today, they're going to mirror what Mr. Wettering talked about in his comments. That is that both of these lawsuits involve the same factual circumstances, and then both of the lawsuits involve the same parties. On the factual circumstances, and I guess before I get to the factual circumstances, I should note there was a question asked earlier about the affidavit of Cheryl Ilkey at Addendum 4 and whether that's part of the record. I went back and looked at what was filed before the district court, and I'm not sure who picked up on that, but that is a correct statement. The affidavit of Cheryl Ilkey was never offered before the district court in an attempt to try and create some sort of issue of fact as to what was and wasn't involved in that first lawsuit.
Were the attachments to that affidavit, namely all of the invoices that show purchases and returns of the feed purchased on June 23rd, were those items submitted to the district court on the motion for summary judgment?
Yeah, Your Honor, there were some invoices that were included. Whether it was the exact invoices that were attached to Ms. Ilkey's affidavit, I couldn't answer that question.
But is it true, Mr. Wills, that you filed an affidavit as well, that, and I think it was letter Exhibit G to your affidavit, in this case, includes the invoices that were used as part of the summary judgment in the collection, and those invoices clearly indicate a credit for the bags returned and for the rest of the feed that involved the allegation now of killing the calves. Would that be an accurate statement?
So it's accurate that the invoices were included. Whether they show a credit for that, I'm not entirely sure. I noted in my argument to the district court that if you look at the initial affidavit or the initial invoice that was provided, the total amount of that initial invoice in the conciliation court matter was $9,163.17. I have down that the alleged bad feed is $1,152. But the total amount of the unpaid feed claim when it goes to district court is $8,743.57, which is a difference of about $400. So
I can at least reflect my reading of the exhibit that you submitted, and I saw it actually. It looks like it was attached to plaintiff's affidavit, or excuse me, appellant's affidavit in this case as well, that it does add up to the exact amount of feed. And I see in your arguments to the district court, you don't really disagree with that. You're making a different legal argument. And
yeah.
So what I'd like to ask you this is, presuming that to be true, we'll double check the math. My question is this, would you concede that if indeed that feed was not part of the collection action, then it's not the same circumstances, because obviously the evidence, the way that Hochschild describes that, would the evidence be the same? Well, in this case, it's a negligence action, not a collection action.
First off, Your Honor, I appreciate you checking the math. In terms of the, would I concede that point? I would not. As the court's noted, the common test is, does the same evidence sustain both cases? And so if we look at that and just assume that Mr. Froderman's argument is correct, that there was a credit provided when the case goes to district court, we still have both lawsuits involving feed that Chandler provided to Mr. Froderman's cows between June and July of 2021. So in that first lawsuit, when we start out in conciliation court, the allegation by Chandler is that Froderman failed to pay for this feed that had been provided. And as part of establishing its claim, Chandler has to show that the feed that it provided was fit for Mr. Froderman's cattle and that there's no sort of offset or credit that would otherwise defeat collection on that bill. So Mr. Froderman's defense before the conciliation court was something that we commonly hear in these sorts of cases. At the hearing, Mr. Froderman said, I shouldn't have to pay for this feed because the feed that Chandler provided was defective. It wasn't fit for the purpose that it was intended. It actually caused my cows to get sick and to die. Now, Mr. Froderman loses that argument at the conciliation court, and he then appeals to the district court.
And when he does so, Mr. Wills, I understand it. It's in some ways as if there was never a conciliation court action. It's a new action in district court. So how is it? I mean, I guess I question the relevance of anything that was said during that hearing. Can you help me with that?
I can, Your Honor. That's you predicted right where I was going to go. That's the argument, right? Because he perfects this appeal to district court, the argument is it's like the conciliation court action never happened. And as I read the rule says that the appeal vacates the conciliation court's judgment and starts the action over, but it doesn't erase what happened at the hearing. I mean, if we change the facts and we say Mr. Froderman shows up to the conciliation court hearing and he testifies, he says, look, there were 10 cows that died as a result of receiving this bad feed. He appeals the case to the district court. And at the district court, he says, actually, it was 20 cows that died as a result of the defective feed. I certainly get to cross-examine him about that and say, wait a second, you told us earlier that it was 10 cows that died. Now you're saying that it's 20. And if the order, for example, reflects that his testimony was that it was 10 cows that died as opposed to 20, I can certainly use that in cross-examination and for purposes of impeachment. So to say, okay, well, you know, because the judgment has been vacated, that acts as some sort of erasure of what happened at the hearing. I completely disagree. Nothing in the rule requires that. And I would think that for the reasons that I've described, that you can still use what happened at that hearing in any subsequent proceeding. But when the case is eventually removed, even if we set that aside, we say, okay, sure. So we're going to say that just gets erased off the map. When the case gets removed to district court, Chandler sends Mr. Froderman requests for admissions and interrogatories. And I think the one that is most key here and most apt is the one that Mr. Wettering brought up in his argument, which is request for admission number 2F. And a lot of these discovery requests, the focus of them is on, okay, well, what's the claim that's coming back by Mr. Froderman based on the defense that he made in the conciliation court action? And so request for admission 2F asked Mr. Froderman to admit that he's not entitled to an offset or a credit against any amount that's owed to Chandler. And an offset or a credit would be, hey, you provided my cows with feed and it killed 257 cows and it caused me damages in excess of $200,000.
Yeah, but if at the time you're in district court, your amended complaint is not seeking recovery for the feed that was returned. So I mean, I get that it was deliveries over a period of time, but having carved this out of the relief your client was requesting in district court on the collection matter, why would we find that any claim that Froderman may have asserted with respect to the quality of the feed delivered on June 23rd, 2021? Why is that part of the facts for purposes of res judicata when your client wasn't ever going to prove up that fact?
Because, Your Honor, if you look at those discovery requests, clearly the intent there at that point is that this feed claim is coming, that's what the defense is going to be to the entire action. Because in my experience, what happens in these cases, and it's not in the record, it's simply commentary on something else that I've got going on right now, but I've got a case right now where there's a bunch of feed that's provided to the farmer that is not defective, and there's still the counterclaim sitting there saying, well, you provided me with another batch of feed over here that is defective. And so you prove up the account claim, and then the only thing that's left is that counterclaim for the defective feed. And that counterclaim still serves as an offset or a credit against whatever the account claim happens to be. So I think it's a situation like we see in the Christensen case, which I realize is a unpublished decision of this court from back in 2018, where the argument there essentially is, okay, well, you know, we have plaintiffs that bring one theory of recovery against a law firm for breach of fiduciary duty, and they've got one factual basis for that claim. They lose on that because they don't provide their affidavit of expert review. And then a year later, they come back and they say, okay, we got this new claim that our lawyers breached their fiduciary duties and committed malpractice to us. And the factual basis is distinct. And so the argument in that case goes, well, look, what we would have used to prove up the first breach of malpractice claim and breach of fiduciary duty claim, that's different than what we're going to use this time to establish that our attorneys committed malpractice. And in that case, this court looks at the fundamental purpose of res judicata and says, look, the question here is whether it's going to result in an injustice. Is it unfair? Res judicata is an equitable doctrine. It's supposed to be applied flexibly. And if you look at, is it unfair? It's absolutely not. In this case, the defense and conciliation court is the feed was defective. He had so, Mr. Froderman.
And to get off the conciliation court, because I don't think it helps us that much when we're in district court now. But I want to understand what you were just arguing about, how the offsets can work. So let's just take a case. There are 10 sales made. Okay. 10 purchases. And let's assume that there's a collection action on 9 of them and not on the 10th. You referred to then a counterclaim that someone could go forward with. What typically happens or would happen is that if you ask, oh, are there any offsets, which would presumably be against the 9 things being collected on, purchases being collected on, that would have to include a claim related to the quality of the 10th purchase. And then you refer to that as a counterclaim. I'm trying to put this all together. I mean, I don't know that there was a counterclaim related to that 10th purchase, right? I mean, the question, I think what you're arguing is that there would be a compulsory, I don't know if you're arguing it's a compulsory counterclaim on the 10th because, or if that he had to answer that somehow if he could prove up that the 10th was negligent, that would in fact offset against the 9th. I don't really follow procedurally this.
And let me try and be more specific so that I can get you there, Your Honor. In this other case that I've got going on, feed deliveries made by a co-op. The feed deliveries are made over a period of several years. There's an allegation that one of those feed deliveries is defective. The co-op sues the farmer because the farmer doesn't pay his outstanding bill. The total amount of the bill is roughly $140,000, I believe.
Does that include all of the purchases?
It includes all of the purchases other than the one that's defective. There's an agreement between the parties that there's going to be a credit for the defective, defective delivery, right? So we don't have the defective delivery included. We've got $140,000 of bills. The AR action has started to recover on the bills. And then the counterclaim comes in saying, well, wait a second, I shouldn't have to pay for any of this because you provided me one load of feed that was defective and it caused damage to my cattle in excess of what your current claim is against me. And so that's, I can tell you from my experience, that is a common thing that happens in the industry. And so we bring a motion for summary judgment on the account claim because there's no argument that those outstanding feed deliveries, that they serve the particular purpose for which they were delivered because the defective one isn't included. The judge grants it. And now all that is left to be litigated in that claim is the claim that there was defective feed provided on the, you know, fifth delivery.
Mr. Wills, on that example you just gave, would not that be better fit as a permissive counterclaim It's not compulsory.
This court's case law is clear that that is a permissive counterclaim, not a compulsory one. And we're not arguing that it's compulsory, but my argument is that within the context of a request for admission being issued that asked, is there any offset? Is there any credit? That necessarily then brings in, is there some other claim that's sitting out there? And the fact that the matter was allowed to go through to summary judgment, and Mr. Wettering said during his comment that after that defective feed, after that invoice is removed, that Mr. Froderman decided, I just don't care about this. I'll let it go to judgment. That statement's not accurate. After the motion for summary judgment is filed, Mr. Froderman's attorneys, the day before the hearings, asked for a continuance from the summary judgment hearing. And that request for a continuance is denied. Now, the obvious reason that they would ask for a continuance is they want to amend their answer to assert the counterclaim, that everyone's sitting there waiting to come down the pike. So
to be clear then, and your theory of the case, if there had not been a request for admissions, permissive counterclaim, res judicata would not apply under your theory. It's because you asked about offsets only, which you would say would capture a potential counterclaim. Is that right? Permissive counterclaim.
So, Your Honor, my argument would still be you can look at some of the purposes behind res judicata, and you can go to that line of case law. But the best argument that I have in terms of why the factual circumstances are different as described in the Hauschild case is because of the request for admissions. That's correct.
Right. Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thanks, Your Honor. So I'll just start with the math of the amount of invoices is irrelevant. He was only disputing this delivery of feed. So the fact that it's $200 or $300 difference, right, addressing that right away, that doesn't matter. And he's bringing, opposing counsel's bringing in evidence from the conciliation court. Counsel's misstating the rule. The case started over with a clean slate. And Judge Bjorkman and Smith, you're exactly right. The amended statement of claim of the June 23rd delivery was not part of the first claim in the district court. So, and I'll pose this question, or what was Froderman required to bring a counterclaim on a feed delivery for which Chandler was not seeking payment and a third party in Hubbard? And as much as I'm glad that he's conceded it's not a compulsory counterclaim, these aren't even the same parties. There's another party unrelated to that previous case. I think this is a pretty straightforward issue of facts, is that Hauschild set forth a caution that res judicata should be rarely used in narrow circumstances where a party has brought a claim earlier and then brought a claim again under the same issues and circumstances. This is not that case. The first case, Mr. Froderman was the defendant. He didn't even bring the first one. This has been his first opportunity. And then I'd like to address the record from the previous district court. It doesn't matter. We aren't challenging any of that record. That's part of our argument of the previous thing, that we let it go to judgment. Okay, the continuance wasn't granted. We're still saying, hey, we admit to those invoices that they're claiming, but once they amended their statement of claim and took that June 23rd invoice out of the record, there was no issue. And just element two of res judicata, are they the same parties and privies? There's no plausible logic that Hubbard is responsible for collecting Chandler's customers' invoices. Not, they had nothing to do with that case. And we believe that the court should go by the standard of United States Brown v. Felsen in the Hochschild standard, that it should be reversed and that res judicata should only be invoked after careful inquiry because it may govern grounds and defenses not previously litigated and therefore blockades unexplored paths that may lead to truth. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. We appreciate them. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. This being the last matter on our calendar for oral argument, we are in recess. Thank you.